place a lot of trust in the companies we do business with. We take for granted that our tap water is clean, that our credit scores are based on accurate information, that the new toaster we just bought will not explode when we plug it in, and that anything sold to us for use by babies has been carefully tested for safety. In reality, a little more skepticism might do us good. And a lot of the protection we count on has only come about due to average Americans speaking up about bad deals. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Marta L. Tejado is president and CEO of Consumer Reports, and she's working to reframe our understanding of the rules and laws designed to protect us from fraud and faulty and dangerous products. Consumer rights, she says, are civil rights, and we all have a role to play in ensuring those rights extend to every single American. Her new book is called Buyer Aware: Harnessing Our Consumer Power for a Safe, Fair, and Transparent Marketplace. Marta, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris.
Why do we tend to overlook economic rights when we talk about civil rights?
That's the question that I asked myself, because being a consumer advocate, it's so logical. And my own personal story, I think, drove that home more than anything. I arrived in the U.S. as a two-year-old, fleeing Cuba after a revolution, and we were here because of democracy, and so that became dinner table conversation, but married really closely to the openness and the rights that come in with a democracy also is economic freedom. And as a new person to this country, you try to navigate the marketplace, because that's where you go to get that car loan, a mortgage. And if you hit up against issues in the marketplace that start to restrict your ability to create a life for yourself, then that really hits up against some of our democratic values. So it was really both of those things. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, you know, we've got to talk about consumer rights as civil rights for a whole host of reasons. And principal among them is that I don't think we can have a democracy that can flourish unless we have a marketplace that is fair, safe, transparent, and just for everyone.
If you came as a two-year-old, it wasn't like you had a lot of preconceived notions about your new home. But I wonder what you remember about your family sort of discovering the things that worked really well, sort of as promised in the United States, and the things that maybe had been a little more elusive than they'd been led to understand.
Well, the first thing you do, right, is you search for a home. Mm-hmm. You arrive in a new place and you look for a home, and you have a sense of trust that you're going to be guided to a neighborhood that is going to be that place that you call home and that feels safe, and that is absolutely a place where you want to take care of what will for most families be their principal asset. And then you realize that there are some unwritten rules in real estate markets that guide certain families to certain neighborhoods. And I tell the story of moving to Newark, and when we finally saved up to buy that house, one of the things you don't realize walking into your home is that the moment we walked into that house, our principal assets started losing value, because we were steered through a process of redlining and blockbusting in a transition neighborhood into that particular neighborhood. So there's a lot about navigating a marketplace that isn't transparent to you. And those are the things you start to learn. And that's a pretty large and complex one. But there's also just, you know, my grandfather happened to be a diabetic, and so we had to hunt around and find what kind of products are going to be consistent with that diet. So how do you interpret what you're reading? How do you ask the doctor questions and challenge certain things that you're hearing, just to try to get the facts? And you know, I recognize pretty quickly how alone one can feel navigating unwritten rules and guidelines that you really don't have access to when you're trying to make decisions that are pretty consequential for your family.
It seems like every few weeks now we hear about hackers gaining access to people's private information. So, of course, we worry about, you know, criminals cleaning out our bank accounts. But you remind us here, tech companies earn a lot of money off our data without actually stealing it from us. Pretty much nobody would willingly sign up for all that surveillance and tracking. Is there anything we can do to avoid it and still do business with these platforms?
Well, that is one of the reasons I felt this book was so timely, because the market is a different place today than it was when my family arrived here. And the irony, of course, is that we were fleeing a surveillance autocratic state, and we arrive, and then you wake up here, and you know, there is a sense that we now have autocratic tech platforms that are surveilling our every move. And we didn't really sign up for that. Consumers were not at the table when they decided, well, we're going to do this and our business model is going to be built on spying on consumers, tracking their personal data and their buying habits so that we could monetize their behavior and sell it to third parties. And so we've gone from being consumers to being commodities. That is a remarkable change, and we didn't really have a choice or say in the matter. And so the book is really a way to kind of rip the veil off what really is happening on this, on these handful of platforms that really are monopolies, and how they structure what we see, the price that we see on some of the things that we're searching for. You know, you go into a store and you see a price of something, and the person next to you sees the same price. On a platform, you go to buy an airline ticket, and as soon as you get onto that platform, they know probably what your income is. They know where you live. They know perhaps what they might want to charge you for that ticket. It's called dynamic pricing. In other words, you might get a price that your neighbor has a very different price on. So that's a dynamic that we've never seen before.
And of course, we can buy that ticket with the low teaser rate and then suddenly realize that, like, we have to pay extra for a snack on the plane and bathroom privileges and a carry-on bag. This is this thing called nickel and diming, which I think a lot of people understand. What is drip pricing?
Well, drip pricing, I also call it the hidden fee economy, right? And that's everywhere. You go to buy a concert ticket and you buy tickets online and they tell you this is the price, and suddenly you go to pay, and if you have a change of heart, you've gone through this entire process, they know more than likely that even if they tack on $10, an additional dollars, you're going to go ahead and pay that price. And you see the same thing on your cable fees, on your phone fees. Hotels are notorious for that, and of course you've already mentioned airlines. So yes, we are now in a hidden fee economy where the price that you see at the beginning of your internet journey is not necessarily the price that you're going to exit that journey on.
And so many times, if we've gone down the road, it can take some time to sort of figure out what we want and decide we want it and put it in our carts. Even if the price becomes unacceptable, it feels almost more unacceptable to start over.
Well, there is testing that companies do precisely that tells them that information. It's the same kind of testing that you see when you're doing a search. And that what we know about our own search habits is that you're going to land on that first search page and you're not going to scroll very far down. And so what you're seeing right now, you take Google, for example, you go to the Google search page, you're looking for something, and very quickly, the algorithm tells you, gives you four or five questions of what it thinks you're looking for. And so they put you in this box, and then immediately underneath it, you might see a whole lot of listings with these tiny letters that say AD or sponsored. Those are all ads, all advertising. For you to get something that's not an ad, you've got to continue scrolling. But they know that your first instinct on search is going to be to stay at that landing page. And that yields a lot more revenue and a lot more advertising dollars.
I've done this a million times, Marta. Like, I start to fill out the information that some website requires for access or to buy something, you know, your name and your address and whatever else they ask for, and then decided this is not worth it. I don't want to give my information and bailed out of that. I didn't realize until I read your book that these companies are allowed to capture that information even if we don't hit submit.
That is correct. Your keystrokes are already being tracked and monitored, and I'm sure you've come up against this many times. You go on a website, you're shopping, and it happens to be a new website and a new store, and you go in to check your name, and it already fills it for you automatically. And so that's always a little jarring, but that just gives you a sense of they know a lot more about you than you know about this platform. And I think it was high time that consumers really recognize and have a little bit more transparency into a major way in which we live our lives now, that they what we you know I often say, after 86 years of providing consumers with the information and the agency they need to make really smart choices in the marketplace, the three alarm fire we have now is that so many of those rules and protections and rights have not migrated to the digital space. We're on an entirely new frontier where consumer power is just being drained from us because we don't have the standards we need or the visibility into some things and the way these choices are being made for us, to recognize the trips and traps of the digital marketplace.
Lately, it seems like a lot more websites do hit us up with messages that ask for consent about the cookies they use, which seems like a step in the right direction. But as it turns out, in practice, it's kind of a pain to go through and articulate what you do and don't give permission for. And maybe that pain point is what these companies were hoping for.
Oh, you're way ahead of me, Chris. That is exactly right. It doesn't have to be that way. Why is it so difficult? Why do I have to answer these five questions? And why is the burden always on the consumer? Yes, they're asking you, and you want to think, oh, they're good guys. They're asking me whether I want to be tracked or not, or what kind of functionality I want. Well, they're asking you a million questions, and they're putting all the burden on you. And quite frankly, if you know what you want, you're going to race right through that and say, accept everything and move on. And that's just another tactic that is based on understanding what our behavior is online. You're absolutely right. There is a way to turn these off, and that's one of the ways in which we're trying to come up with new tools and ways to advise consumers. It's very burdensome now to begin shutting those doors and tracking, and so we have a security planner that you can go to on our site. It's free, it's available to everyone, and just any device you may have, your smart TV, your vacuum, your cell phone, it takes you through a step-by-step process on here are some things you can do right now to begin having a little bit more control over your data, a sense of greater security, and a feeling that perhaps your data isn't being leaked elsewhere when you download these apps.
Marta, lots of apps on our phones ask permission to use geolocation data, which, seems necessary for mapping and maybe delivery and rideshare services, not for a lot of other things that ask for it anyway. And once we've granted permission to an app to track where we are, they can use that information for whatever they want.
That is absolutely correct. My advice to everyone is no geolocation. Don't allow them into your contacts. Only use the permissions that require that app to function. Just because they're asking you doesn't mean it's necessary for the app to function.
Can they share that information with third parties without our knowing?
Oh, they absolutely can. As I mentioned earlier, Chris, the scary thing is there aren't. It's not like it's not legal. It's fine. There are very few rules, regulations, and guidelines that protect consumers in a digital marketplace. And so you talk about apps. Let me just give you a couple of examples. One of the things that's really popular now too is peer-to-peer payment apps, right? So it's an easy way to pay back a friend for a restaurant bill or a much larger bill. You might be sending some fast cash to a son or a daughter at college. What folks don't recognize is that these peer-to-peer payment apps and a lot of the financial tools online don't have the same protections. And so if you happen to press the wrong contact name or you press the wrong or the number somehow you mess up and you send that money to someone else, not every one of these apps are going to make you whole again. And so we've been rating those tools as well, because again, you need to be aware that there's a lot of risk here and not a lot of protection.
Doorbell video cameras are everywhere these days, and they're nice, speaking from experience, if someone steals your porch furniture, but many people may not realize we're all being recorded by these same cameras as we're going about our business, right? Walking the dog and weeding the flower beds. Our neighbor's camera is picking us up, and our neighbor might share their own footage with police without ever letting us know.
Well, that's right. You're walking up and down your neighborhood, and the popularity of these things are make it very likely that your walk, your innocent jog, is really been filmed. And there have been, and I tell the story in the book of a gentleman who was the police showed up at his house, assaulted him on his lawn, brought him to his knees because there was a video of him. They thought it was him. It wasn't. And they arrested him, and it wasn't until they realized it wasn't him. That's pretty scary. It is. But we don't realize that this footage can be turned over to authorities and to anyone. And you're part of that video, just like facial recognition. What we know about facial recognition technology, just think about how many buildings and places that you've gone to where you've got to pose for a photograph. And well, do you know exactly where that is going and who owns it and what happens to that? Is it just to get into that building? We don't ask ourselves that question, but we need to be cautious. It is a way of life now, but a way of life that doesn't necessarily protect or secure your rights.
Sometimes I think that if any one of us could see the full dossier that any given corporate entity has built on us based on our digital information, we would, you know, turn off all the options and really secure our privacy rights. But there's no easy way, is there, to find the complete file that is being kept on any one of us by Google or Apple or Amazon?
No, I'm very curious about mine, and you can imagine, but it is made quite difficult. And that has to change. We need to be the owners of our personal data. We need to be the owners of our health data. And that's a scary thought when personal information like that is being shared. And actually, even something like a credit score, you mentioned this earlier, what we've learned about credit scores, and it's such a critical marketplace tool, because your ability to get a loan or a car is contingent on what your score is. And we found that many consumers have erroneous credit scores. And you have these credit score apps, which are really just vehicles to track you and to get more information from your devices from you, and then charge you to have access to your credit score, when in fact, by law, you have access to your credit score and it should not cost you any money. And you also have the ability to correct it. So I try to give folks tips in the book on just how to do that. Simple things like that, that we just have to, you know, use our own agency and correct. But again, the burden is on us.
Historically, antitrust lawsuits were brought based on allegations that some corporate tactic to kill competition had the effect of making goods and services more expensive for consumers. Has the law kept up with this era when companies like Facebook and Google don't usually directly charge their users for most of their services?
Yes. Well, antitrust is absolutely pivotal to a vibrant market economy. We know that competition is something consumers are going to be dealt a more fair and more transparent economy. And it's also great for innovation and great to see small businesses flourish and a variety of choices for consumers. And of course, right now, much like the laws, the consumer laws, the antitrust laws are really not keeping up with this new world of, you know, four or five monopoly platforms that are dominating what we see and what we don't see. And of course, as you say, in the old economy, the analog world, pricing was something that folks tracked as, is it harming consumers or not? Well, in the new world, it's not just price. It is our privacy, it's our security, it's the data tracking, it's the limited choices, and it's platforms that are not just serving you up information, but they're also, they're new sources, they're shopping sites, they're single entry points in a variety of different industries, and we're just not seeing our laws keep up, and technology is not going to stop and pause and wait for that to happen. We need to see more robust enforcement of the laws we have, but quite frankly, we need a whole new set of rules and guidelines about how does a digital marketplace thrive for consumers. At the moment, it's the big platforms that are writing those.
Marta Teodo is president and CEO of Consumer Reports. Her book is Buyer Aware. Hackers, of course, are the criminals who break into servers and steal our data, but we entrust that data in the first place to the companies we do business with. What sort of accountability do they have, and what sort of accountability should they have for not preventing those breaches?
Well, funny you should ask that question today. This happens to be Cybersecurity Awareness Month in this country, and I just came back from ringing the bell at NASDAQ for Cybersecurity Month, and this is a global issue. The notion of hackers and security and how we change our behavior and culture. And one of the thoughts and points I made to some of the industry representatives there this week is the same point I made on the show, and that is stop putting so much of the burden on consumers. Take security and the what you need to do, both industry and government, to create less of a burden for us. We know that our personal information is at risk. We know that we've seen what breaches can do. We've seen the Equifax breach and what that does. And consumers are getting letters in the mail. We think you've had a breach. Okay, what do I do now? Do I freeze my credit score? How do I do that? We're not as agile in that way, but it's important. And sometimes they don't even advise. They don't tell you that you've had a breach. And so you find out maybe a year later. So there's a lot to be done there. But I think one of the things this cuts to the heart of is trust, right? So many of the issues that we've been talking about is the lack of trust, that we have in the marketplace, the lack of trust we have in government and industry, and we know this from asking consumers. And so you sit back and say, well, how do you rebuild that trust? And I think it is with transparency and accountability. And unfortunately, at this time, we have neither of those. And so we've got a lot of work to do. And the only way we're going to move that needle, I think, is if consumers start raising their voices and demanding a different way about this.
What do we do about all the fake reviews that appear on websites? I mean, they're relatively easy to spot when you go somewhere and there's 100 reviews and they're all 5 stars and they're one sentence each, but often they're more subtle than that, aren't they?
They are. So let me give you some tips on how to smell out those fake reviews and scams that you see on the internet. I've already mentioned one, you know, look for those ads and promoted. But the other thing is to, you know, if you're looking at a review, don't just read the first three. Kind of peruse some of them. Because what we know is that there is something called positive review hijacking. So if you're on the Amazon platform, what we know is that there's some backdoors and loopholes where you actually just take a bunch, and I mean 100, of great reviews, and you just migrate them to another product that is not so great. And there isn't, given the scale of the platform, we know that self-policing is not effective. And so again, the burden is on us to think about those reviews with a little more of a skeptical eye. Look at the recency of that post. Look for the same positive language that doesn't feel authentic, that's already a lot of work to do. And I guess the principal thing to understand is that many of the reviews and rankings sites out there, those are advertising sites. Those are pay to play, if you will. They are getting, and this happens on even on YouTube, where there's this the rise of influencers, celebrity influencers that tell you this is a great product. Well, that's commercial. They're being paid to say that. But it takes on the feel of, well, this person is someone I trust, they're my friend. But in fact, it's not an unbiased, independent review. And to this day, that is why we don't accept advertising, and all of the revenue that we create for the nonprofit comes from our members. I think that's the only way to build trust.
Just to sidetrack for a minute here, Marta, I'm a fan of the magazine, and I've always wondered about the logistics. Consumer Reports, you purchase all the magazine purchases all the products that are used for review. How does that happen? What happens to those goods after they're used? What is the process?
It's a great question, and it's one that I get often because people don't know about it. Now, I didn't even know about it when I came to Consumer Reports. So we are pretty rigorous testers. We have about 63 labs in our headquarters in Westchester. We have a 327-acre test track in Connecticut. And you're right, we spend $30 million a year rating, reviewing, purchasing products and services. That covers about 9,000 ratings and reviews, hundreds of different categories. So what happens to all those products? Well, we have auctions, and we have auctions for the staff, and that's one of the great benefits for, you know, our 500 plus people who are so mission-driven at Consumer Reports. So we make really good use of those products. And as you say, we also have an army of what we call secret shoppers. So we don't want to get special deals from the manufacturers. We want to go out and buy those products, buy that car, roll it off the parking lot just like a consumer would, and experience that product and test that product just that way. And that's pretty much what we do. I mean, if you think about it, our auto testers, you know, they put at least 500,000 total miles in the vehicles that we test, and I'm told that that's about equivalent to circling the Earth 20 times. So it's pretty rigorous stuff.
What is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and why do you despise it so much?
Oh, 230. Let's talk about it. Now, Chris, we're really in inside baseball. Section 230. Well, here's the thing. I was talking a little earlier about how these platforms, Facebook, and you know, are not just quote unquote a social network. It's a shopping platform. It's a news platform. They generate content. People believe that content, right? We are tr we go onto these platforms, we read things, and some of the content that the more outrageous what we've learned about and what their own research tells them is the more outrageous that content, the more you'll keep coming back and liking and liking. And so you get this divide of opinions because it actually generates traffic and engagement. It's that's perverse. That's also tearing apart the fabric of our country. And so how do you hold companies accountable? So there's this thing that everybody is struggling with. It's like a tug of war, and it's called 230. And 230 is a way that they kind of slip out of what we call liability, right? Because if they're just a social network, why would we hold them liable for news and facts? And to me, that is a real problem. That's a real sham. Now, there's the debate because there's also a sense of, wait a minute, that's freedom of expression. I think we have to call this what it is, and come together and see just a little bit more effort on if 230 is trampling on freedom of expression. Let's not argue about that. Let's fix the problem we have right now, which is mistrust.
Marta, as I mentioned earlier, I really am a fan of Consumer Reports and what it does. I will say I've had the experience in the past of, you know, having a perfectly good blender in my kitchen and then reading Consumer Reports assessments of what the best blenders are out there and suddenly finding myself thinking, well, I don't have the very best, smoothest operating, you know, most efficient blender. Do you and other folks at the magazine think a lot about the possibility that Consumer Reports might unintentionally encourage overconsumption?
That's a great question. And I remember when I first took this job, people were like, well, maybe you should change the name because consuming and consumer is a bad word in a world where I think all of us want to live a sustainable life. I think what we're encouraging is really smart, thoughtful decision making. And that is also why we introduced our Green Choice rankings now, which are not only in our cars, but also in all the home appliances, because I want to look at a product in its entire life cycle. How is that made? What's the usage? And how is it going to be disposed of? I think more and more of us, rightly so, have to look at our consumption within that sustainability framework. So we're working really hard on the greening of the choice making. So I appreciate that question. I think that has to be factored in, and we see that with our members as well. They want more information about that, and that's a pivot we all have to make, without a doubt.
Okay, on to safety, which for many people is maybe the most important consumer concern of all. You remind us that the kinds of safety equipment we now take for granted in cars happened only because activists pressured lawmakers to require things like seatbelts and airbags and anti-lock brakes. It's not something we can leave up to market forces alone, is it?
Not at all. That's true. We all now just take for granted that seatbelt was sort of the idea of a manufacturer, and that there must be must have been a law. Well, that wasn't the case. We had to fight for that. We also just 5 or 6 years ago succeeded in fighting for the backup camera. The backup camera, you cannot make a car now without a backup camera. Sounds crazy, but that's the case. And now fast forward, if the state-of-the-art technology for safety in your car was the seatbelt decades ago, well, now it's that plus all that incredible life-saving technology, and we know it's life-saving because we have enough data now, forward collision warning, blind spot warning. Unfortunately, that technology is still considered a luxury item. And so that's troubling when life-saving technology has a price tag on it that you can't access. That has to be standard, and that is what we are arguing. And we've told some manufacturers, unless you make it standard, we're not even going to consider your cars in the top 10. And as soon as we said that, guess what started happening? They started moving in the right direction. That's the kind of positive incentives I think our membership allows us to make in the marketplace, because the reality is government mandates move very slowly, and we don't think one should risk one's life waiting for that to happen.
Back inside baseball now, what is Section 6B of the Consumer Product Safety Act?
Oh, well, that one makes my heart sink. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is something any consumer advocate is proud of, right? That didn't exist in the heyday of the consumer movement, and it's now the agency that is supposed to be protecting us. 6B, I talk a lot about that in the book in the context of a heartbreaking story that took years to fix, and it took too many years and too many lives, and that is an inclined infant sleeper that is at an inclination for newborn infants. And mind you, no pediatrician signed off on this product when it was put on the market. New mothers and fathers assumed that this product was safe, and what we know is that product is responsible for over 200 infant deaths, and it took years to stop it. And why did it take 2 years? Well, there is an arcane law, and it's called 6B. And what 6B allows is, if the Consumer Product Safety Commission has data that knows which manufacturers, which of their products are causing harm, they, by law, don't need to share that data with the public. And when they share it with us, they redact the number, the names of the manufacturers. And that is something that industry succeeded in doing, and we've been trying to take out for years. And what happened, and this shouldn't be the case, that we shouldn't be saving lives by a bureaucratic snafu, but we request data from the CFPC all the time. They sent us the data, and one day they forgot to redact the name of Fisher-Price, which was the culprit. And we went to print with the story, even after they threatened us and told us, you can't do that. And we said, well, actually, we think we can. And you could read the painful story in the book, but that's absolutely insane. So yes, we need laws to protect us, and yes, we need to look at the ones that are working against us.
I hadn't realized until I read that chapter that a lot of things that are sold to us for use by very tiny babies are not specially tested, are not, as you mentioned, you know, signed off on by pediatricians, may just be the product of the marketing team.
Absolutely. That's right, Chris. You know, unfortunately, we do. We go and we see something in the store, we see it online, and it's a great product, and they're great reviews. And you buy it, and you have no idea that that was not tested. You know, those bumper pads that are sold in cribs, absolutely a no-no for a child. So many of the things that we're still fighting for, just the furniture that tips over because there's no voluntary standard. We know that children like to climb up on furniture. Well, there's a lot of furniture out there that does not meet current standards. Basic physics tells us. We're still working hard to have that legislation passed as well. So very cautious. New parents, unfortunately, you have to be very cautious about what you bring into your home. You assume that safety is there. It's not always the case.
And the solution for furniture that tips over is for, you know, manufacturers not to build furniture that tips over easily. But instead, sometimes they get away with, like, you ought to anchor this to your wall, which in practice, you've learned pretty much nobody does, including, you know, parents who are trying to be conscientious but have a lot on their minds.
Well, that's right. And the problem with furniture is that there's so many cases where these are voluntary standards. Why? We have the data that demonstrates that this is what children do. And, you know, bolting them to your walls is just a poor substitute for responsible manufacturing. And I'd say the same thing for technology. We want revolutionary technology. We want revolutionary products. But put people first. We want it to be responsible, and we want it to be accountable.
Often when we buy a product or service, we're only allowed to buy it if we sign off on the contract, right? And those contracts will include agreeing to terms of service, which might include what's called forced arbitration of disputes. Why are these almost always a bad deal for the consumer? Arbitration sounds like both sides get to weigh in.
Well, it certainly does sound that way, but that's not the case. And this is caught on in the marketplace like wildfire. You absolutely don't know that. You could buy something online, buy something in store, and the fine print says as soon as you buy that product and pay for it, you are subject to what's called mandatory arbitration. And what that means is that you can't hold them liable in a court of law. All you can do is sit down with them and argue the case with an arbitrator of the company's choice. That, to me, is coercion. That is not fairness. A number of companies have rolled that back because consumers have used that tool against them. So Amazon, for example, used to have mandatory arbitration, and consumers got onto it and started filing huge efforts, you know, en masse, and they finally said, you know, this isn't such a great idea, and they stopped it. So, I mean, that demonstrates that raising our voice and coming together can actually make change happen. But it's a nefarious little scam and scheme that really just puts, just drains the power away from consumers.
Marta, payday lenders have come in for a lot of criticism in recent years because the interest they charge for those small loans is really high. But the reality is many people do sometimes find themselves in situations where they need cash before they get paid. Is there any way to do something like payday lending ethically?
Well, the challenge is that we need tougher guidelines to incentivize ethical lending, right, in the payday business. What we see is payday lenders congregating in vulnerable neighborhoods where there are so many unbanked, and we need to see more reputable banking and lending institutions across communities that are challenged. And so we have a growth industry of payday lenders that are servicing and really putting people who are most vulnerable in a whirlpool of debt because they have no other choices. So we need to crack down on payday lenders, put more restrictions on them. They have incredible lobbying power in the halls of power, and we continue to fight against them. So I talk a lot about that in the book, and I hope those tips are going to be helpful. But we have more work to do there. It's like whack-a-mole. It's just dreadful. They're preying on the most vulnerable families in the U.S., and that's just inexcusable.
I don't remember seeing this in the book, but I've wondered about those tax preparers that say, if you do your taxes with us, we'll just advance you the refund you're about to get right now. You don't have to wait for the government to pay it to you. Are those a good deal or a bad deal for people?
Oh, I'd be cautious. I'd be really cautious. I do have a section in the book where I talk a little bit about that, and I also talk about something that is also heartbreaking, which is folks who read the section of the newspaper where you have the deaths announced, and they call people up who've just lost someone and say, "Hey, we can get your inheritance on a fast track if you just pay us up front." Again, it's a scam. It's an absolute scam. It's unfortunate, as I say, it's an obstacle course out there, and it shouldn't be, online and offline. And I've seen it up close and personal. My father, who signed up for what he thought was a long-term care insurance policy, only to learn 20 years afterward that it was not worth any, had no cash value, and there were so many restrictions, he was never going to see that money back again. Perfectly legal, but so unethical.
Besides being careful about who we do business with, what power do all of us have to help build what you call a consumer-first marketplace? What can we do?
Well, the book is really a playbook. It's a playbook and a call to action. We're talking about some pretty heady stuff. We're talking about democracy, ethical business practices. But every family has to make decisions every day, whether it's that loan, the college loan, the mortgage, the car insurance that we know is generated by an algorithm that's not going to get you a fair market price. And so I try to fill the book up with what I think those in the moment advice is. But I think for some of these bigger issues that we're struggling with as a country and as a marketplace, that is creating one that is consistent with our democratic values, and that really, as FDR said, our freedoms are no half and half affair. If we guarantee equal opportunity at the polling place, we have to guarantee equal opportunity in the marketplace. That's going to take all of us raising our voice. And I can tell you that, and the book is full of examples like this, where I can go and testify before a committee about something. But when I show up with and talk about millions of people that are part of our 6 million community and say, "We need to see this change, and here's why, and here's the harm," you start to see change.
Marta El Tejado is president and CEO of Consumer Reports. Her new book is called Buyer Aware: Harnessing Our Consumer Power for a Safe, Fair, and Transparent Marketplace. Marta, this has been so informative. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you, and I hope you visit.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.